Thank you for holding, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Cardiac Conditions Conference Call. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end of today's conference. Instructions for asking questions will be given at a later time. Today's conference is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may now disconnect. I thank you for your attention, and I now turn the conference over to your host, Performance Improvement Coordinator at iPRO, Ms. Linda Shells. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our second collaborative conference call. The topic of discussion for today's call will be cardiac care. Our speakers are Dr. Monty Malik, Medical Director here at iPRO, and Dr. Stephen Scheidt, Director of Cardiology at New York Presbyterian Medical Center. Their discussion will focus on acute myocardial infarction and chronic heart failure. At the end of the call, my colleague Linda Rosato and I will kind of wrap up the discussion and review Jenny, our online community forum, and we'll talk a little bit about some improvement methods as they relate to the cardiac topic. Before we begin the discussion, I'd encourage all of you to go to the collaborative website, Jenny, which will provide you with an outline and some slides so you can follow our discussion today. You get there by going to Jenny, that's spelled J-E-N-Y, .ipro.org. And please do not type in www. Before it. I'd like to begin the call now and introduce to you Dr. Monty Malik. He's medical director here at iPRO. He's been here for many years. I'm sure most of you know him. He's a clinical professor at both Downstate and New York University. He's a master of the American College of Physicians, a fellow of the American College of Cardiology, and a past president of the American Society of Internal Medicine. Dr. Malik is going to begin talking to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Linda, and welcome everybody. And I'm pleased to have with me a good colleague and internationally known cardiologist, Stephen Scheidt, whom I will introduce formally shortly. I'm going to talk to you about the AMI and CHF studies in which you folks are collaborating with iPRO in a joint effort to try to improve the care by virtue of improving the use of quality indicators and the need to document that the utilization of the quality indicators. I'm sure most of these people that are on the phone with us do not need to be educated about the quality indicators. You're aware of them. Certainly this went on from both the sixth and the seventh scopes of work, and it looks like it's going to be on with the eighth scope of work. One of the problems with the numbers and documentation has a lot to do with a process of care and a process of documentation. We have found that there are many ways to help you improve the documentation, and these include the use of standing orders in the emergency room or CCU, the use of a discharge protocol, a clinical pathway, and it very much helps if there's a physician champion and a physician leader who's respected by the other physicians on the staff. It's important to have a very cooperative and knowledgeable nursing support staff as well as administrative support. I would call to your attention, and by the way, as Linda mentioned, we will be posting shortly, in a day or two after the conference, slides on both my presentation and that of Dr. Scheidt, and we also will try to list a lot of the references that we make during this call. I would call your attention to a couple of articles that appeared in recent issues of the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, one of which is entitled Cardiac Protection During Acute MI, Where Do We Stand in 2004? It's an excellent article. It was in the June issue. And also at the same time, there was an article from the guidelines of the American College of Cardiology, Enhancing the Quality of Care for Acute MI, the Focus of Improvement Change from Key Indicators to the process of care. And that's partly what we're going to be talking about today and what I've already indicated to you, that it isn't just the knowledge of what's supposed to be done, but it's not only getting it done, but documenting it in the chart. And that's one of the big problems we've had, because I can't tell you how many physicians indicate that they use all the quality indicators, but when we look on the chart, there's no evidence of that having happened. So it's important. There are certain problems that have come up with some of the quality indicators. The first one I want to mention is about antiplatelet therapy. As you know, aspirin has been in use for a long time, going way back, and was shown, as you know, to be almost the equivalent of streptokinase originally, and it has stayed on the list of things that are very important for the 30-day mortality, the long-term mortality, and reducing recurrent coronary events. On the other hand, a drug which has come along more recently, also an antiplatelet drug, working a little bit differently, called clopidogrel or Plavix, has now become very active on the market, which is being enhanced by the fact that insurance carriers are now paying for this drug. And the reason this becomes a problem is that when a patient is admitted to the hospital on Plavix, if they're not put on aspirin, they are not conforming with the CMS quality indicators for acute MI, even though an antiplatelet drug is being used. I think Dr. Scheich will probably comment further on that particular thing. Some of this may be affected by the CAPRI study, which I hope Dr. Scheich will talk with you about shortly. The next thing I wanted to talk about on the quality indicators are the ACE inhibitors. As you know, the ejection fraction of less than 40 with AMI is the hallmark for the use of ACE inhibitors according to the CMS quality indicators. On the other hand, there have been quite a few studies now to suggest that MIs are helped by the use of ACE inhibitors. I make reference to the HOPE study and also the Europa study. The HOPE study used ramipril and the Europa study used perindopril. That's not available in this country, but basically both of them showed a remarkable 1 to 4 year drop in the incidence of recurrent coronary events and stroke. There are several other studies also, including the Valiant study, which make it clear that with acute myocardial infarction, ACE inhibitors have a very important place. The next thing I wanted to mention briefly is smoke cessation, which is part of both of these studies. It involves the need to ask the patient whether they smoke, and if they do, to provide them with guidance or a method or medication to help them discontinue smoking. As you know, IPRO has a big collaborative on this, which Dr. Stimler has put forth, and some of you may well be aware or be participants. The next thing I wanted to mention has to do with revascularization. Here, the phrase, three words, time is myocardium, is the most important thing you can remember, because basically the guideline is, as you know, for thrombolytics, 30 minutes start to needle time. For angioplasty or PTCA, it's 90 minutes start to catheter time. There have been many studies now suggesting that revascularization with the use of angioplasty is probably preferable and does decrease significantly the worry about stroke. Therefore, I do make mention of the Danami studies. There were two of them, 1 and 2, and also the Prague study and the original PAMI study, which suggested that you could do this in patients with acute myocardial infarction, do it effectively, and actually delay perhaps a little bit in doing the angioplasty, in some instances where a half or a full dose of thrombolytic was given first. But the basic issue here is that time is myocardium. And here again, there's a process in the emergency room from the time the patient hits the door as to whether or not you can timely get in either the thrombolytic or get them to a cath lab if that is available, or even in some instances transfer them to another institution where it can be done with or without a dose of thrombolytic first. Now, one important issue which, unfortunately, in the current quality indicator list and in the protocol for the acute MI that has been put on a test indicator only, which I'm in hopes and everyone is in hopes that with the eighth scope of work in August of 05 comes in, lipid management and treatment will be a primary quality indicator. I'm sure most of you are now well aware of the benefits of statins, and in particular the early benefits of statins, as shown by the MIRACLE study and the ESTABLISH study, both of which showed that early administration of statins improved the outcome of patients with acute MI. There are many, many studies now on both primary and secondary prevention of both strokes and coronary events by the use of statins, and there are multiple statins that are involved. It's not 100% clear whether or not this is absolutely a class effect of all the statins or whether or not some are doing better than the others. Certainly, there are at least a dozen effects of statins that are called pleiotropic effects, and I just wanted to take a moment to mention them because it's such an impressive list. First of all, we know that statins decrease stroke and recurrent coronary events. We know they help stabilize plaques, and the reversal study several other studies have raised the question of whether or not they not only stabilize plaques but may actually make them shrink a bit. The statins are anti-inflammatory, and since we now believe that atherosclerosis and coronary disease in particular is an inflammatory disease, there is a notable benefit by reduction of markers of inflammation such as the CRP, IL-6, TNF, and macrophage activity. We know that statins improve endothelial function, doing this significantly by upgrading the activity, or upregulating, I should say, of nitric oxide, so that if the endothelium activity is improved, there's less likely stasis and clotting. The statins are basically antithrombotic and antiplatelet drugs. They significantly do affect coagulation. They actually decrease the AT1 receptor density, meaning that they decrease the likelihood of a coexistent hypertension, and patients with atherosclerosis tend to have both hypertension and coronary artery disease. We know that the statins will decrease carotid intima thickness, which has a lot to do with the process and the progress of atherosclerosis as it can be measured in the carotid arteries. We know that there have been reports now that there's less atrial fibrillation. There's actually decreased mortality associated with CABG, with sepsis, and even with the normal percutaneous coronary interventions, that those patients who are on statins do better. And one side interesting issue is it's been shown in one or two studies that it actually decreases beta amyloid, which may be a significant thing with regard to Alzheimer's disease. Some of you may be aware that at IPRO there's been a depression project going on. It's not that we're depressed. It's just that we are studying this in association with acute myocardial infarction, and we had a recent publication from IPRO on this and preventive cardiology. And the importance of this is, although it's not currently a quality indicator, is that it's not really attended to. Physicians frequently don't have the time to try to recognize and treat depression, and it is important because it seems to have an effect on the occurrence of MI, that is, depressed people tend to have more MIs by several studies, and also when they do have it, there are certain physiologic effects which give them a higher risk. For example, it does increase platelet coagulability, and that's very important, as you know, and that's one of the things that aspirin and statins do reverse. Depression is associated with a loss of heart rate variability, and that's another important issue because when there's loss of heart rate variability, there's an increased morbidity and mortality from coronary disease. And patients who are depressed tend to lack compliance with both their regular medication or any medication, with diet, and tend more likely to be smokers. Depressed patients are more often readmitted. They have an increased cost of care and length of stay. And certainly we are aware that the SSRIs in treatment of depression may actually reverse some of these physiologic effects. Now, those are just several overviews on some concerns and things regarding the patients with acute myocardial infarction. And again, following my presentation and that of Dr. Scheidt, we will have time for questions and answers. I would now like to move on to the congestive heart failure part of this conference. I'm sure, again, you're all aware of the quality indicators and the compliance that is necessary by documentation. I will not repeat those references which I gave you regarding AMI, which are equally applicable here. But certainly the processes of care tend to help. And it's particularly important with CHF on the six items that are necessary to be recorded on the chart for discharge instructions. These are very important, and frequently four or five out of the six are done, but not necessarily all six. And that's where the process of having a discharge sheet or a mechanism of making sure that these are taken care of at discharge is so important. But again, with CHF, the gold standard for therapy is ACE inhibitor. There's been a lot of concern and a lot of problem because a large number of physicians now find in practice that their patients with congestive heart failure are treated with angiotensin receptor blockers, or the ARBs. And the reason that's important is that many of the physicians who treat patients with ARBs are doing so because they have practically no worry about side effects. The angioedema, the leg edema, the cough, and other issues related to ACE inhibitors are not present with ARBs. There are many studies which suggest that there may well be a quality of effect of ARBs with ACE inhibitors, including the fact that they act at a different location in the angiotensin, actually the protocol or the process of raising blood pressure. It has a big difference with regard to the angiotensin 1 and 2, and it works at a different place than the ACE inhibitors. There are multiple studies, and I believe that Dr. Scheidt is going to discuss this with you, including the CHARM studies, which used candesartan, and these was actually three separate studies, one with candesartan, one at the same time as an ACE inhibitor, and one in those patients who are ACE intolerant. He will also probably mention to you the ELITE 1 and ELITE 2 studies. There's also the RESOLVE study, in which candesartan was compared with enalapril, and the VALHEFT study, in which valsartan was compared to a placebo. There are several other concerns about the ACE inhibitors, one of which is the dose. None of the studies, including the quality indicators from CMS, talk about the dose of ACE inhibitors. And if we were to comply with the dose used in the studies, we would be seeing a lot larger dose of ACE inhibitors used during the course of treatment. Unfortunately, I frequently see, and I'm sure you're aware, that somebody orders 5 milligrams of Vasotec and says, oh, that's it, they're on an ACE inhibitor. But it may have nothing to do with the fact that the studies certainly were up in the 20 to 40 milligram range. So it's important to recognize that we may or may not be getting the full benefit of ACE inhibitors if we're not using an appropriate dose. As far as the side effects, there are articles and publications regarding this, and I will leave some references for that when we post them on the internet. Basically, I have covered most of the area that I wanted to go into, and without the further ado, I'm now going to introduce to you Dr. Stephen Scheidt. I'm sure he's very well known to everyone in this audience. He's a professor of clinical medicine and director of the cardiology training program at the New York part of New York Presbyterian. He's on the IPRO board of directors. He's a former governor of the American College of Cardiology and vice president of the American Heart. He's the author of many, many, almost 175 articles in the literature, and has written several books, and is on editorial boards. And so at this point, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. Stephen Scheidt. Steve?
Thank you, Monty. All of those credentials are totally irrelevant. You are all probably most interested to hear that no, I have nothing to do with President Clinton. I'm downtown at New York Hospital Cornell, and he's uptown at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia. But I understand he's doing well. I just want to take a few minutes to try to remind everyone what we know and what we have forgotten about some of the clinical trials that might explain why CMS, why the feds and others have the quality criteria that they have. I'm going to go backwards and cite the criteria, and with apologies to David Letterman, I'm actually going to do them backwards because we can get a number of them out of the way very quickly. Let me begin with the acute MI quality measures, and again, going backwards, one criterion is the proportion of people with primary angioplasty who have hospital arrival, so door to needle time, door to angioplasty time of 90 minutes. Dr. Malik said, you know, time is myocardium. We call it time is muscle, whatever you please. But obviously, the chance of an MI and the size of an MI and the possibility of preventing an MI entirely is greatly dependent on time. So 90 minutes or less, that one's easy. The proportion of patients who get thrombolytics, door to needle time of 30 minutes, same thing. Multiple studies have shown that the possibility of a small infarct, the late ejection fractions, the death rate, both in hospital and for the next 6 to 12 months, and even the possibility of preventing an MI entirely, all of that is critically dependent upon door to needle time. So once again, from a Letterman point of view, door to angioplasty time of 90 minutes, that one's easy. Door to needle time with thrombolytic therapy of 30 minutes, that's easy. Again, going backwards, next criterion. Beta blocker within 24 hours after hospital arrival. This is the proportion of patients without a contraindication. Why on earth would anybody not give a beta blocker, given the fact that beta blockers reduce heart rate, they reduce myocardial oxygen consumption, therefore they would be likely to reduce ischemia and therefore pain. They reduce blood pressure, and obviously heart rate and blood pressure are determinants of myocardial oxygen needs, and they're anti-arrhythmic, particularly ventricular arrhythmias. So beta blockers need to get beta blockers immediately, really, in the emergency room. Going backwards, the proportion of patients, another criterion, without beta blocker contraindications who were prescribed a beta blocker at discharge. Again, multiple trials going back 20 years. Actually, the sicker the patient, the more the usefulness of a beta blocker at discharge. But indeed, why would you not prescribe a beta blocker? They limit heart rate so the patient can exercise. They limit blood pressure so the patient will not have as much myocardial oxygen needs. They're likely to reduce angina, and they are somewhat antiarrhythmic, and they also probably have a small role in preventing atrial fibrillation. Again, you ought to give a beta blocker or give a reason why not. And clearly, asthma, bronchospastic disease, peripheral vascular disease, where you know that peripheral vascular disease will get worse on the beta blocker, or even there certainly are patients who have had beta blockers in the past and complain because it reduces their joie de vivre, their sex drive, or whatever else. They just can't tolerate it. Perfectly reasonable, but you do have to document in the chart that there's a reason not to give beta blockers. As for Letterman, we're number five reason, number five CMS criterion. Proportion of patients who are smoking, who are giving smoking cessation advice or counseling. Of course people should stop smoking. We all know that. It is a matter of documentation. One simply has to, either on some sheet or with some process, document that the patient was offered. And I wouldn't just say advice. One probably ought to offer current smokers something. Either these days there's nicotine chewing gum, there are nicotine lozenges, there are nicotine patches. All of those are mildly helpful in getting people to quit. And that gets us to Letterman's top three indications, and I want to take a little more time to talk about that. Number three is the proportion of patients who were prescribed an ACE inhibitor at hospital discharge. Now, here we come to a curious situation. I think we all know that ACE inhibitors are absolutely indicated for people who have low ejection fractions, but indeed people post-MI in a number of studies, even if they don't have overt failure, and in some cases even if they don't have a very low ejection fraction, there tend to be fewer cardiovascular events over the next several years. So, but the criterion says with left ventricular systolic dysfunction, which is an ejection fraction of less than 40%. With no question, people do better post-MI, half a dozen trials from SAVE through other trials. ARBs are not in the CMS criteria here or in the failure criteria. And so we'll talk about that in a moment. The fact remains that in both situations, the literature is older for ACE inhibitors, and there are just more data, more patients. So either use an ACE inhibitor or tell people why you're not using ACE inhibitor, prior intolerance, prior cough, some other reason. Aspirin at hospital discharge. Well, you already heard Dr. Malik talk about Plavix in some cases replacing aspirin. I don't know what to say about this. Aspirin, as you all know, irreversibly acetylates receptors, the platelets. It is a relatively weak anti-platelet aggregatory drug. It works only on cyclooxygenase. Different people react to different doses, but aspirin has stood the test of time. Plavix, clopidogrel, is a drug where there are a few trials, but I want everybody to remember what the Plavix trials showed and didn't show. The trial that is frequently cited is something called CAPRI, which was a big trial, Lancet 1996. I think it's in Dr. Malik's list of references. It was 19,000 patients with a recent stroke, a recent MI, or symptomatic peripheral vascular disease. And it was aspirin versus a regular aspirin, 325 milligrams, versus Plavix, 75 milligrams. Now, the bottom line that we all sort of remember is that long-term Plavix was more effective than aspirin in reducing the combined risk of stroke, MI, or vascular death. But none of us, including me, before I went and looked it up, remember what CAPRI really showed. CAPRI was not statistically significant. It was 20, for the overall group. And it, in terms of subgroups, when you look at what happened with MIs, actually for patients with myocardial infarction, Plavix had about a 4% higher risk. Wasn't statistically significant. It was the same. But the benefit in the CAPRI trial was in the people with peripheral vascular disease, not in the people with stroke and definitely not in the people with myocardial infarction. So it is a mistake to rely on the CAPRI trial to show you that Plavix is as good as aspirin. That's point number one. Point number two, in the CURE trial, which, if you remember correctly, was several thousand patients who had unstable angina, non-ST segment elevation, MI, it was Plavix plus aspirin versus aspirin, and Plavix won by a considerable amount. But let me point out that unstable angina is a very different disease than myocardial infarction, particularly ST elevation myocardial infarction. It's a disease that is probably associated with plaque rupture. It's a disease that has white thrombi because very frequently, most of the time, there's not total occlusion of the coronary artery. And to presume on the basis of that trial that Plavix is better than aspirin is unfair. Aspirin has tens, if not hundreds of thousands of patients that show benefit versus placebo over a long time. So I have to tell you, and by the way, there is recent data to show that there is such a thing as Plavix resistance. Plavix is a thienopyridine drug that works on the ADP receptor, but there are loads of other ways of producing platelet aggregation and thrombosis. So Plavix is not the be-all and end-all of anti-thrombotic, anti-platelet aggregation drugs. And it is now that people have started to look, there clearly is Plavix resistance, clopidogrel resistance, and there's actually an editorial in Circulation a month ago, and it seems actually that people who are resistant to Plavix may have a higher rate of complications in after unstable angina for a good many months. The fact remains that I think on balance CMS is probably correct, that we can bitch and moan, excuse the French, as much as we want, but I think that aspirin is a standard drug and we ought to put people on aspirin. If the patient is on Plavix for some other reason, or certainly if you do angioplasty, the patient has to be on Plavix, or if the patient has had an acute coronary syndrome, a non-ST elevation MI, within the past 9 months, and you want to keep the patient on Plavix, if you have a good reason for Plavix, that's fine. My suggestion would be to then add 81 milligrams of aspirin, or else you do have to put a note in saying patient must be on Plavix because such and such, such and such, such and such, and therefore aspirin is not being used. But if you don't do that, you will actually be marked down by CMS, and I don't think it's unreasonable that they do so. And now finally, the last quality indicator for acute MI is patients without aspirin contraindications who receive aspirin within 24 hours. That certainly is reasonable, and indeed we tend to tell people actually to chew aspirin because we know that aspirin makes a difference in terms of the number of clots that you can break up. So much for AMI. Now, as far as congestive failure is concerned, again, going backwards, heart failure patients discharged home with written instructions or educational material, weight monitoring, follow-up appointment, discharge meds, diet, activity, and what to do if symptoms worsening. I think weight is extraordinarily important. Weights need to be written in the chart. They need to be written down for the patients, and you have to be sure that patients have scales. All of this is obvious, but you know there are many, many trials to show that attention to these small details actually reduces reinfarction rates. If people have a process, not reinfarction, I'm sorry, at rates of readmission to the hospital, which certainly saves us, the taxpayers, money. So that's perfectly reasonable. Then, again, proportion of heart failure patients who are smoking, who are given smoking cessation advice, yes, of course. And now we get to the one that's really tough, and that is heart failure patients with systolic dysfunction who are prescribed an ACE inhibitor at hospital discharge. Now, you've heard Dr. Malik comment that ARBs, angiotensin receptor blockers, are not, I repeat, not considered equivalent by CMS to ACE inhibitors. And you need, if you're not using an ACE, you need to tell them why. Obviously, if the patient's had cough or other intolerable side effects, it's perfectly reasonable. But our concern today is this question of, you know, should we as a routine start with an ACE inhibitor or start with an angiotensin receptor blocker? And let me just remind you now of what we do know and what we do not know in terms of clinical trials. The key trial is something called ELITE II, which was 3,000-odd patients with failure and an ejection fraction less or equal to 40% randomized to losartan, COSAR, versus captopril. Now, there was no significant difference in mortality, but it was actually about 13% higher with losartan. So a worse outcome, higher mortality. It was 17.7% deaths with COSAR and 15.9% deaths with captopril. I won't even mention the fact that captopril is available generically, and of course losartan COSAR is not, so it's considerably cheaper. But the fact remains that in ELITE, where there was a direct head-to-head trial of precisely the kinds of patients that the guidelines are written for, people with failure and a systolic ejection fraction less than 40, actually the ACE inhibitor won by a nose, not a significant, but by a nose. Then there's the Valheft trial. Valheft was another head-to-head trial. 5,000 patients with failure and an ejection fraction less than 40. Captopril, enalapril, lisinopril, and then they were randomized to valsartan versus placebo. Now, the intriguing thing is that the valsartan alone in people who were not on ACE inhibitors was useful. It was beneficial. It did reduce mortality, morbidity, and hospitalizations. But most of the benefit was actually in the people not on ACE inhibitors. And when you looked at about a third of the group, it was 1,600 patients who were on an ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker. And, of course, that is standard of care today, an ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker. And when you looked at those 1,600 patients, there was actually a 40% increase in mortality. This was an adverse effect adding the ARB. So adding an ARB to an ACE inhibitor, although it theoretically makes sense, there's escape from ACE inhibition because there are non-angiotensin ACE inhibition ways of producing angiotensin II, and it is theoretically better to block the receptor, but nobody's really shown that the combination is actually better. And then finally, we've all seen a drumbeat of interesting recent trials where the ARBs did beautifully. And let me please remind you that almost none of them are actually ARBs versus ACE inhibitors. There's the LIFE trial, great trial, 9,000 people with hypertension and LVH. So they're high-risk hypertension. They already have end-organ damage. But that was losartan, COSAR versus atenolol, and the patients on COSAR did beautifully. No argument. People with hypertension and LDH, you want to use an ARB, that's fine. But this trial doesn't tell you anything about what an ACE inhibitor might or might not have done. Similarly, the CHARM trial. CHARM, Dr. Malik mentioned, Candesartan, and CHARM was a big, big trial, and CHARM was patients with heart failure, and was Candesartan, which is Atacand, and in general, it was Candesartan versus placebo, or it was Candesartan added something else, and then there was Candesartan in people who were intolerant of ACE inhibitors. That was CHARM alternative. And again, the patients did quite well, and in a number of these trials, not only does the ARB do good things for blood pressure and overall cardiovascular events, but it's also good for diabetes, and it's good for proteinuria and all that sort of thing. I'm a big fan of angiotensin receptor blockers. But when you come down to the simple question, is CMS nuts to ask us to slightly favor ACE inhibitors rather than ARBs as our first reflex? I think the answer is no. There is no big head-to-head trial that shows that the ARB is better. And there are at least two trials that give you a little pause that maybe the ACE inhibitor is slightly better. It doesn't matter whether we think CMS is nuts or not. At the moment, those are the criteria. They're the criteria we need to live by. And I'll throw this back to Monty now in about 60 seconds. We all need to remember that reporting is going to become both more universal and also is going to have somewhat different consequences. As you know, quality reporting is an idea whose time is finally coming around. It's not just CMS that's going to give extra for reporting quality data, but there are a number of insurance companies that are moving in that direction. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan already has a situation where they not only are going to pay extra to hospitals who have quality measures in place and good outcomes on the quality measures, but they are beginning to pay hospitals that do not have, either don't have the measures in place or don't do well on the measures, they're going to pay those hospitals less. Let's not let that happen here. I would suggest that those of you who are in a position in your hospitals, and those are presumably the people on this conference call, those of you who are in a position to make a difference, the key thing is you need to tell people. I don't think people realize that if you don't write it in the chart, if you don't at least explain why the patient's on Plavix, not aspirin, that you should add aspirin if the patient's on Plavix, that you should explain if the patient's on an ARB, not an ACE, why, and you probably should favor the ACE inhibitor to begin with. If you don't put this stuff down, the hospital is going to lose points, which at the moment is sort of theoretical, but within a relatively short time may actually have considerable consequences. Let me, who it does not work for IPRO, let me thank everybody in advance for being part of what I think is a reasonable movement toward quality. I think that if we collect statistics, if we show the statistics to the people who actually render the care, most of them have good hearts. They recognize that quality is good for everybody, the patients, the hospitals, the system, the taxpayer, which is us. And I wish you all the best of luck in this wonderful endeavor. Dr. Malik.
Thank you, Dr. Scheidt. And there are a couple of things I wanted to just get to before we go to the question and answer. One, I wanted to make it clear as I could that you heard the discussion about Plavix versus aspirin. There will be no credit for any other documentation because it will be required that a patient with AMI on admission and discharge get aspirin, whether or not they're on Plavix. And basically, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that there is any reason why someone on Plavix, other than the fact that that might be causing more bleeding, could not get aspirin.
No, Monty, we actually discharge everyone, even after angioplasty, on Plavix, 75 milligrams, plus a baby aspirin.
Right. So in other words, the quality indicator for the AMI is aspirin, whether or not they're on Plavix. And the other question I wanted to raise with you, Steve, was the now, I think the literature suggests that anywhere between 10 and 20% of people may actually either be aspirin resistant or non-responders.
Are you talking aspirin or Plavix resistant?
Oh, aspirin. There have been several reports that I've seen suggesting anywhere between 10 and one report suggested it might even be as high as 20% of people who do not seem to get the platelet effect of aspirin.
That's correct, but at the moment, at least, we don't have any good way of finding these people. It is theoretically attractive to put somebody on two different categories of drugs because my guess is that 10 to 20% are resistant to aspirin, to the cyclooxygenase inhibition, and 10 to 20% are going to turn out to be resistant to Plavix also, to the ADP pathway of platelet aggregation blockage. And if you put people on both drugs, it's theoretically very attractive. Aside from the fact that Plavix costs $3.50 a pill, and aspirin costs you know, pennies. I think what Monty is trying to get me to say, and I will say it, is that 81 milligrams as a standard dose post AMI. We're not talking about somebody that's had serious disease. 81 milligrams is too small. It's based on theoretical criteria, looking at platelet aggregation in a few, nice subjects who sort of looked at venous blood and platelet aggregation and test tubes. That's not the real world. So that, yes, absolutely, I would actually much rather, I think, for the moment, until this is proven, in people who haven't had an angioplasty, in people who don't have an indication for Plavix, and in people who haven't had acute coronary syndrome but have just had a big MI, I think they ought to be on a higher dose of aspirin, not a lower dose.
I couldn't agree with you more, Steve. You got the hint. I would point out that going back as far as 1973, I, among others, have done a study to show that aspirin is not equally absorbed by everybody on studies doing salicylate levels and by other measures. The last thing I wanted to mention before we go to the questions and answers is to make it clear to you that there is concern about being a specific class effect or not a class effect of the virtue of ACE inhibitors with acute myocardial infarction. There was a study which is published, and I will reference it on the site, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the last issue, comparing quality effects of the ACE inhibitors after MI, and pointing out that ramipril, which is the drug, which is also known as Altase, which was the drug that was used in the HOPE study, has a very much better effect on the end results after MI than the other ACE inhibitors. And that was in the July issue of the Annals. Steve, I'm going to open it now to questions. And operator, Nancy, would you come in and tell the folks how to do this?
Of course, doctor. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press a 1 followed by a 4 on your touchtone phone. If for any reason you need to retract your question, please press a 1 followed by a 3. All questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, for questions, please press a 1 followed by a 4 on your touchtone phone, please. Our first question comes from Miss Katie O'Leary with Park Ridge Hospital. Go ahead, please.
One of the problems that we have here particularly is in patients with renal problems. And it is routine practice here that providers will document their BUN or creatinine or rise in BUN and creatinine and assume that chart abstractors will understand they are not prescribing ACE inhibitor for that reason. I know there has been some discussion in adding renal failure as a contraindication for ACE. Can you give me some idea where things are going with that?
Well, I can tell you, and I'll ask Dr. Scheib to get into this immediately, but I can tell you that increasing creatinine levels are a contraindication for the continuance of ACE inhibitors. On the other hand, by the same token, patients with CHF who have mild renal failure are frequently improved by the use of ACE inhibitors. Steve?
Yes. Clearly progressive increase in creatinine is a very good reason to stop, and I think all one needs to do is link the stopping of the ACE inhibitor to such a progressive increase. On the other hand, I see it all the time. I saw it this morning on rounds. Somebody goes from a creatinine of 1.0 to 1.3, and house staff stops the ACE inhibitor. That makes no sense to me whatever. I think that one ought to try. I think that the data are quite good for clearly patients with failure where you have a mortality morbidity benefit. We, after all, are treating patients, not numbers. And also for people with any vascular disease like the HOPE trial. The HOPE trial was 5,000-odd people over the age of 55 with any vascular disease, by the way, peripheral vascular carotid coronary disease. And that group with ramipril 10 milligrams only did quite well. So I think that one absolutely should try the ACE inhibitor and see what happens.
Any thought, I know you had mentioned we're treating patients, not numbers, one of the things people here are looking for. Is there some kind of a number cutoff where one might consider placing their hat, so to speak?
What's your cutoff point, Steve?
Well, I get antsy at 1.8 to 2. It's very hard to give you a definite answer. Clearly, if the patient had an angiogram yesterday and the creatinine went from 1.2 to 1.5 and now you start an ACE and it goes from 1.5 to 1.8, I'd stop almost immediately. On the other hand, if the patient's been bouncing around from 1 to 1.4 you dry the patient out a little bit and start an ACE and it goes to 1.6 and it hangs there, or even 1.8 and it hangs there, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Okay. But we should definitely be looking for them to document that an increase in creatinine is their reason for not prescribing an ACE.
That's correct. It is important that any increase in creatinine is noted, and that if that is the reason why ACE is not used, that be documented.
Thank you.
That's the key issue there.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Ms. Karen Nelson with North Shore. Go ahead, please.
Hi. We've had several physicians question why the PTCA door-to-needle time does not take into account the onset of the patient's symptoms.
This is an ongoing problem for a long time. When we talk about 30 minutes door-to-needle time as being the time when you have to get a thrombolytic in, it takes into consideration that you probably have to get a thrombolytic in within 6 hours or less of the onset so that you're going to have the expected benefit. Once you go beyond that and up to 12 hours, the risk of the thrombolytic causing hemorrhage or bleeding is greater than the benefit, Steve.
Yeah, but I think the question was angioplasty, but it's the same question. When do you start? Do you start from the major chest pain, or do you start when the patient rolls in the hospital door? I think that it is so difficult to come up with the time of onset of the infarct. I agree there are some people who wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning and have 10 over 10 chest pain, and it's perfectly obvious. They never had chest pain before, and they get into the hospital quickly, and they have ST elevations. Perfectly obvious when the starting time was. In many other people, it isn't so obvious. They've had pain for the last 2 or 3 days and stuttering and this and that, and you really don't know exactly exactly when it started. So I think that's why when you're trying to equalize things among hospitals, it has just become door to needle or door to angioplasty time. Those are things that are under the control of the hospitals. You know, there shouldn't be delays getting through triage in the emergency room. There shouldn't be the clerks running around trying to get insurance data. There shouldn't be in the old days before IPRO and Malik and people like that got started with things, the thrombolytic or such was kept locked up somewhere upstairs, and you had to page the cardiology fellow who had to come across the street and unlock it. I mean, those are things under our control, and therefore it's reasonable if you're going for quality criteria to say door two. Is that fair, Monty?
I think you're correct, and I would also point out that in the DENAMI 2 study, as well as the 1 study, in the entire country of Denmark, which probably doesn't have the same traffic jams we have here, within 3 hours, they were able to transport patients from the time of onset to get an angioplasty done in well over 80% of the cases. So it's something that requires the ability to transfer a patient, especially in the upstate hospitals in New York, where there may not be in that hospital the capability of doing either catheterization or an angioplasty. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, for questions, please press a 1 followed by a 4 on your touch-tone phone, please.
All right, I think if there are no questions further at the moment, they may be occurring to people, and we'll come back to it if we have more time. I'm going to turn the meeting over now back to Linda Shields and to Linda Zotto, who will go over some of the other aspects of the collaborative.
Thank you, Dr. Malik. Before I begin, I just wanted to make mention of a few things. Dr. Malik, you mentioned that IPRO had just completed recently an AMI depression study, and the listeners, if they're interested, can go to cardiacblues.com and download some materials if they'd like. And that's cardiacblues.com. In addition, you mentioned that we have a smoking cessation collaborative in progress, and yes, we do. And it's my understanding that it's been extended until April of 2005, and if the listeners have a need for any further information on that or would like to participate, they can go to our website and click on smoking cessation and get some information about that. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about Jenny. If you remember, I referred all of you to Jenny before Dr. Malik spoke and asked you to go there to look at the slides that we have prepared for this discussion and the outline that Dr. Malik had prepared. And some of you on the call might not be familiar with what Jenny is. And it is the name of the online community forum, which was created originally for this collaborative. And it's now expanded to all communities of practice. It's extremely user-friendly. It's a wonderful information-sharing tool and a very, very convenient way of accessing information. And there is a ton of information to be found on this site. For instance, in terms of data abstraction, for those of you on the call that are focusing in on heart failure or acute MI and have questions in terms of the population eligibility or the inclusion-exclusion criteria, they can go to the site and click on the heart failure forum and then click on the information for data abstraction resource, and they'll get everything is right there. All the quality measures are listed, the eligibility
is listed, the inclusion-exclusion criteria is listed. So it's really pretty great. And if they're interested in acute MI, the same holds true there. If they went to the MI forum, they could click on and get the information for that. And we've been getting a lot of calls asking for that specific information. So this is really great because it's just all in one place. In terms of quality improvement resources, again, if you want to get some information about, specific information about a quality measure you're interested in working on, and you want to review some barriers or process changes or some concepts, if you go to that particular form, topic-specific form, and click on quality improvement resources, you'll get that information. And in addition, hopefully in the very near future, we'll begin to get the hospitals to kind of share information and we can see what each other, you know, are doing. So if you, you know, we strongly encourage all of you to go to the site and take a look and see what's out there. I'd like to now turn the call over to Linda Rosado, a colleague of mine, and she's going to kind of talk about AIM statements and process changes as it relates to this collaborative.
Hi. For those of you who are in the process of beginning your pre-work activities, what I'd like to do is review the tips for writing an AIM statement, building on the last collaborative phone call. I suggest that you look at your organizational needs. If you've collected data, evaluate the data for which measures need most improvement, and take into consideration things like, are there a large number of patients affected by the lack of conformity to this measure, or does the lack of conformity create a significant patient risk? Prioritize your measure. What's the most important measure that you need to improve, or measures that you need to do? What measure or measures meet your facility's needs can be improved, given your resources, your staff, your clinician barriers? Do you have a physician champion who can help you? For example, if you look at your data and there's a large number of AMI or CHF patients that are not being provided smoking cessation counseling, you should take a look at your process and evaluate it. Does it require a change, or is there a knowledge gap or a lack of resources, and that's why it's not being done? Consider the resources and barriers. What changes can you make? Be realistic. Can you improve the percentage of AMI or CHF patients with a history of smoking who receive a cessation counseling from 40 to 60% on a single unit within 2 weeks? Or if you've chosen another quality measure, can you improve the percentage of patients receiving complete discharge instructions from 30 to 50% on the day shift or on a single unit within a week or 2 weeks? You need to look at your clinician barriers. These are potential ones. Are there a lack of resources? Is there a lack of staff or equipment, time? If the clinician believes that it's not their role or responsibility, then it's going to be difficult to make a change. Primary care physicians that lack involvement in the treatment or preventive care could be a barrier. Belief that these services should be carried out in another setting. And if there's a concern about the potential adverse effects for medication or treatment or procedures, look at your organization because you know it a lot better than anybody else and to see if there are any clinician barriers. If there are, what change concepts can you use to overcome these barriers? And some sample change concepts are design a system to avoid mistakes. You may need to revise forms to include documentation that's required. You could automate. You could use reminders. You could standardize a formal process. You can conduct training. Some intervention strategies would be evaluate your compliance with current processes, make some modifications, educate your clinicians about your data, the quality measures, and this is to explain the need to change and motivate your workforce. Use standing orders, clinical pathways, protocol, care protocols, and algorithms. You could use reminder systems, which are automated, if that's possible in your organization, with medical record checks, with forms, guidelines, or you could use non-automated hard copy forms, templates, and stickers. You need to test your changes. Think small, test rapidly. Test your innovative changes on a small scale. Start with changes that are easy to implement. Monitor progress daily or weekly using well-defined and easy-obtained measures. Did you accomplish what you want? If so, spread it to other units or other physicians. If not, reevaluate, modify, and retest. To conclude, we want to run through where we are at this collaborative. We hope that you will complete a pre-work activities worksheet and submit it as soon as possible. We left the level of your participation up to you, but we ask that you submit a pre-work activities worksheet so we can adapt the collaborative to your needs. We'll then proceed with the action period in November once you've received your senior leader and run chart information. This is when you'll be implementing your change on the measures and using the PDSA cycles. I just wanted to remind you that the attributes of a collaborative are action-oriented. We want everybody to learn, everybody to teach. They're results-oriented. We want to accelerate improvement, create a sense of support, create a sense of urgency and competition. And I wanted to let you know what you can expect from iPro is we'll provide information, we'll offer you coaching, we'll provide communication venues for shared learning, we'll give you status reports, and we'll maintain your safe and safeguard your confidentiality. And we would ask you if you would please take some time at the end of this call to complete the evaluation on jenny.ipro.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we find out if there are any more questions, I wanted to make particular reference to one article which I will post, the June 16th issue of the JACC, Journal of the American College of Cardiology, in which they specifically mentioned barriers and strategies to handle the barriers for the use of tools and for the use of quality indicators. It's a very impressive article, and I strongly refer it. I'd like to find out now if there are any further questions for Dr. Scheidt or myself.
It appears that we have no further questions at this time, Doctor.
Before we wrap up the call, I'd like to let everybody know that if they missed the first conference call, August 31st, titled Introduction to the Collaborative Model, the call was recorded and it's going to be posted onto Jenny. So if anybody's interested, they could certainly listen to the call and download the materials from that call, as well as this one. If there are some folks at your facility that were unable to listen to this call and you'd like to share that information with them, they'll be able to listen to this call as well at a later date. And I want to remind everyone the next collaborative call is scheduled for September 13th, and the discussion will focus around surgical infection prevention. And September 15th, we're going to be discussing community-acquired pneumonia. And I really strongly encourage everyone, if they have the time, to really surf around and take a look at Jenny, because I think it's really terrific. And, you know, we're hoping the hospitals will kind of share their success stories and we'll all be able to learn from failures and swap processes and protocols and learn and share from our peers. It's very easy to register. Again, it's very user-friendly, and please take a look at it. Are there any questions either for Linda or myself before we end the call?
We do have one more question from Charmaine Cross with Woodhill Hospital. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have to apologize. I came in the conference call late. My question is dealing with Jenny. I didn't get any website address or information where I can access this information.
Sure. After the call, if you stay on, I can call, and I'll be happy to provide that information.
I'll be fine. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
Steve, did you have any final remarks or statements?
Nope.
Okay, I want to thank Dr. Scheidt very much, and I want to thank everyone who took the time to participate in this conference. Again, I remind you, please fill out the evaluation. It helps us in programming further such conferences, and we'll be hoping to hear from you in many respects regarding this and the rest of the quality services. With that, I think we will close and wish everyone a good day.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation.